This week, Australian ISPs win big in copyright court case. Google cooperating with the NSA with Google's network security. And UK government asks the public to report suspected terrorist websites. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 14 for Thursday, February 4th, 2010.
He said, an open internet is a powerful engine for economic growth and new jobs. Letting large companies block and filter online content and services would stifle needed growth. What is your commitment to keeping the internet open and neutral in America?
Well, I'm a big believer in net neutrality. I campaigned on this. I continue to be a strong supporter of it. My FCC chairman, Julius Genachowski, has indicated that he shares the view that we've got to keep the internet open, that we don't want to create a bunch of gateways that prevent somebody who doesn't have a lot of money but has a good idea from being able to start their next YouTube or their next Google on the internet. So this is something we're committed to. We're getting pushback, obviously, from some of the bigger carriers who would like to be able to charge more fees and extract more money from wealthier customers. But we think that runs counter to the whole spirit of openness that has made the internet such a powerful engine for not only economic growth, but also for the generation of ideas and creativity.
Today's decision is very disappointing to the film industries who launched the case and to the 50,000 Australians who are employed in the Australian film industry. But we believe this decision was based on a technical finding centered on the court's interpretation of how infringements occur and the ISP's ability to control them. INF accepted the evidence we provided as legitimate proof of copyright infringements on their network. We are confident the government will not intend a policy where rampant copyright infringement is allowed to continue unaddressed and unabated across the internet.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture, knowledge, control the world. And that is losing its last controls. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for all the links to all the stories mentioned during this show. The intro clips that I had off the top of the show, one was from a video from today, February 4th, from a representative from AFACT after they lost the copyright court battle with ISPs in Australia, and I'll have some more on that later in the show. And also a YouTube interview with U.S. President Obama a couple days ago on February 1st after his State of the Union address to the U.S., and I'll have some more of that later in the show as well. Let's go to the incoming messages. Crunge emailed this to me and also posted it in the Pirate Party Radio forum. Data.gov site allows for submission of ideas for it to improve. Ideas are moderated and voted on. I submitted an idea for them to distribute the entire dataset via BitTorrent quarterly. This idea passed moderation and now is available for voting. For one, this data should be made available to by as many means as possible. Secondly, if the US of IP federal government were making use of BitTorrent to distribute media, it would be hard for a court to say that the use of BitTorrent is inherently suspect. So please go and vote on this idea up and circulate the link to people who care about the free flow of information and the legitimacy of BitTorrent. And there's a link in the forum. So that's a good idea from Crunge about a good distribution method of governmental data so that everybody who's sharing the data can help spread it and lessen the burden from the government and the costs associated with hosting that kind of information. So if you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. Let's get on to the pirate news. Copyright news from Australia. Pirate Party Australia welcomes the decision in the IINet trial. The Pirate Party Australia welcomes the decision of Justice Cowdroy in federal court today, and whilst AFACT will most probably appeal this decision, we take it as a victory for the for common sense. This is a good decision by Justice Cowdroy and reflects that there is no legal basis or obligation for any ISP to act in the interest of copyright holders, or to expect that they should disconnect any entity upon allegation of infringement without judicial oversight and due process. Essentially, an ISP should be considered similar to the Postal Service. They simply carry data in the form of packets, and that communication should be considered private, said Rodney Sierkowski, party secretary. He continued, "We still believe that reforms of the Copyright Act are necessary in order to make them more representative of the realities of the digital paradigm, and better reflect the way in which we relate to information, culture, and knowledge. While this judgment may be a step in the right direction for the rights of Australians, there is still further work to be done in regards to preventing further injustices from occurring in regards to data security and cases involving file sharing." Senator Conroy has previously indicated that the Australian government seeks to expand the war on sharing, and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade is currently engaged in secretive negotiations of the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA. ACTA has been shown in leaked documentation to contain requirements that could ultimately lead to a graduated response or a three stripes type regulation. The Pirate Party Australia completely rejects these kinds of regulation as a reasonable response to internet file sharing. The internet has been woven into the everyday lives of Australians. We're dependent upon it socially, culturally, and economically. It is simply unacceptable to disconnect an entire household from such an important medium of communication, upon often baseless and incorrect allegation from the industry-related associations without due process. An example of the sloppiness of which such allegations includes takedown notices sent to a network printer at the University of Washington for illicit file sharing, said Rodney Sierkowski, party secretary. It would place a regulatory burden on ISPs, meaning increased costs for consumers, and in many respects is simply not feasible without gross violations of privacy. Moves to three stripes type regulations would likely mean that in an attempt to either keep their communications private or to avoid detection, many people would turn to encryption. Law enforcement agencies in Britain have stated such regulations would subsequently increase costs of prosecution and make investigation more difficult. The use of a graduated response or three strikes technique to lower piracy rates is flawed. Disconnecting an entire household for often unprovable claims without a fair trial is not what I'd consider to be representative of a democracy and just society, said David Crafty, president. A graduated response mechanism is a threat to the privacy of every Australian. Pirate Party Australia is entirely against the implementation of such a scheme and welcomes the public to join up against any development of such legislation. So thankfully, the court case was decided in favor of the ISPs as a more common carrier type status, where they don't have to inspect all the packets going through them just because somebody has an allegation of copyright infringement going on. And I was speaking with David Crafty in an interview on another radio show recently about such things. It was on a Great Southern Stand radio show, and I'll also link that in the forum posts for links, and you can check out my conversations with David Crafty and the host of the show. Worldwide copyright news. Brussels denies rumors of secret anti-piracy treaty. An upcoming global trade agreement on copyright and counterfeiting, known as ACTA, will not rewrite EU rules on liability of internet service providers, a leading European Commission official told Euractiv, denying media reports that suggest otherwise. The anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which began in Geneva 2 years ago, is pure plurilateral trade agreement to establish international standards on intellectual property rights. According to former trade negotiators, the countries attempted to clinch an agreement under the banner of World Intellectual Property Organization, but as members could not agree, like-minded nations formed ACTA. Participants in the last round of talks in Mexico included Australia, Canada, the European Union, Spain in its capacity as EU president holder, an unnamed EU member state, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Morocco, New Zealand, Singapore, Switzerland, and the United States. The next talks are scheduled to take place in April in Wellington, New Zealand. The leading commission official said media reports were oversimplifying the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which wrapped up one stage of a series of negotiations in Mexico last week. The official declined to be named due to a non-disclosure agreement. The European Commission has been privy to secretive international trade talks on counterfeiting, which have been ongoing for 2 years. Policymakers have protested against the secretive nature of the talks and allege that trade envoys are seeking to bypass the political process and introduce unpopular policies. A cross-member party group of MEPs will send a letter to the Commission today, February 4th, demanding minutes and documents from the negotiations. MEPs claim that they are due immediate and full information on international trade agreements under the terms of the Lisbon Treaty. A commission told Euractiv that the EU executive trade offices have been providing information to MEPs on ACTA whenever possible. Conservative MEP Syed Kamal confirmed that the commission had informed the parliament of the talks' progress, but he said commission officials cannot say much as they are bound by a non-disclosure agreement. The parliament will not be able to influence policies emerging from ACTA, but they will have the chance to veto the agreement if it is unsatisfactory, according to policymakers in both EU executive and the legislature. However, both MEPs and commission officials say it's unlikely that the parliament will reject ACTA. The European Parliament will be asked to give an assent to ACTA, Martin Collier, advisor on international trade for the Greens EFA group in the European Parliament, told Euractiv, saying that a parliamentary no would unravel the agreement and send Commission back to the drawing board. But Collier added that the Parliament will be expected to endorse ACTA as it would be a sign of mistrust in the European Commission if it did not. It is crystal clear that ACTA will go through, Collier said. So that is very interesting that it's looking like a rubber stamp will be put on ACTA as it goes before the EU. Even said by people, members close to the EU, an advisor for international trade has said it right there. And hopefully by that point, at least some details of what is contained within ACTA as it goes before the Parliament of the EU, goes before the EU for voting on, that some details of it will come out of what is happening in it, because right now it is completely secretive, and that's pretty much unacceptable for international treaty for when this is going to affect the citizens of the countries. Copyright news from the UK. Newsbin Usenet indexing trial day one. After coming under legal threats from the MPAA in 2008, the Newsbin.com Usenet indexing site began its defense in London's High Court yesterday. Newsbin are reporting that the judge appears remarkably switched and they are looking forward to a fair trial. In 2008, Newsbin received complaints from the MPA, the MPAA's big brother, who raised questions over the legality of their operations. Later that year, Newsbin confirmed that the MPA had chosen to file an injunction against the site. Yesterday, the showdown of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation and others versus Newsbin Limited began before in a high court in London's High Court before Justice Kitchen. The case began at 10:30 on Monday, with the barrister for the plaintiffs making his opening statement. As reported by Newsbin and in a 3-hour speech mostly being full of how evil we are, the barrister explained what Usenet is along with a description of Newsbin. The file format originally created by Newsbin, the NZB, also had its functions explained along with an explanation by the barrister of how they compare to hyperlinks. Newsbin noted that much effort was put into trying to convince the judge how NZBs were differed from hyperlinks. Accusations were also leveled at Newsbin's back-end code, which the plaintiffs claimed is designed to go looking specifically for copyrighted works on Usenet. In contrast to the long speech by the plaintiffs, Newsbin took little time to state that they disputed most of what had been said so far and would address this in evidence to come. Later in the day, witnesses for the plaintiffs were produced, along with including representatives from the MPAA-funded Federation Against Copyright Theft, FACT. They didn't have much to say under cross-examination, apart from they did a half-assed job analyzing our site, Newsbin reports. Other witnesses include some junior lawyers who confirmed that they had harvested data from our listings, but didn't bother to check how much of it was actually under any form of copyright. According to Newsbin, the star of the show was an expert witness who was cross-examined for an hour at the end of the day. Apparently, he reported that it would be dangerous to auto-open an NZB metafile file in a browser since it could lead to the user being infected by a virus. Strange guy. Newsbin indicated they are happy with Judge Justice Kitchen, who they believed is remarkably on the ball and switched on. They're confident that this will be a fair trial since Justice Kitchen has already pulled up the plaintiff's barrister on several points. This judge certainly won't be blindly eating everything he's told by the MPA, Newsbin adds. On the other hand, it doesn't mean he'll accept our arguments easily either. And the case continues, it says. So this is a very interesting case because it's very similar to just Google indexing websites and files contained on website, because the NZB file all does is take what is on Usenet and puts it in an easy to access form. Whether it's not its copyright or non-copyright, it's just listings in an alternate form from the Usenet, which is sometimes contained on ISP servers themselves. So it's just an indexing site, in my opinion. So this will be something very interesting to watch. And also, since Oink recently was also proven innocent, the runner of Oink's website was proven innocent recently in a court case in UK as well. So some of those proceedings could have influence on this court case. Something to watch as it goes on. Privacy news from Australia. Attorney General Michael Atkinson's backflip, no consolation. Prior Party Australia wishes to express its dismay at the recent amendments of the Electoral Act and its disgust at Attorney General Michael Atkinson's apparent contempt for the South Australian public. The South Australian Attorney General commented with respect to new amendments requiring anyone making an online comment about next month's state elections to publish their real name and postcode. Mr. Atkinson said there's no impinging on freedom of speech. People are free to say what they wish as themselves, not as somebody else. Matt Redman, South Australian Pirate Party spokesman, said, "Every citizen in a democracy has the right to question the government, and in doing so has the right to protect himself from censure. Even within the narrow scope of this bill, the government has limited what people will be able to say without fear of retribution. Besides being ludicrously unenforceable, this amendment merely demonstrates that the government has no interest in representing the people." He continued that Ms. Resmond and the opposition raised no substantial objections to these amendments, shows that they are just out of touch with the internet generation as the incumbent government. Rodney Sierkowski, Pirate Party Australian Secretary, criticized Attorney General Atkinson's comments. "Such comments are completely and utterly ignorant. Anonymity is an essential part of political discourse in any democracy, and an essential part of the freedom of speech. Mr. Atkinson does not seem to realize that somebody may choose to maintain their anonymity due to fear of harassment, political or economic retribution, and even sometimes threat to their lives. It is necessary for whistleblowers, those struggling against repressive government,
government, and so forth. So the Australian Pirate Party puts it very succinctly there, that if you can't speak out in anonymity, you could be persecuted for what you say, whether it's by the government or if that data falls into other people's hands who disagree with you and have strong opposition to what you say. So if people can't speak out without fear, they won't speak out at all, and things of importance won't get out there to the government to be able to make change in what's going on with them. Worldwide free speech news. WikiLeaks whistleblower site still in temporary shutdown. WikiLeaks, a whistleblower website that allows people to publish uncensored information anonymously, has suspended operations owing to financial problems. Its running costs include staff payments are $600,000, but so far this year, it has raised just $130,000. WikiLeaks has established a reputation for publishing information that traditional media cannot. The website claims to be non-profit and relies on donations. A statement on its front page says it's funded by human rights campaigners, investigative journalists, technologists, and the general public. WikiLeaks does not accept money from governments or corporations. A list of names and addresses of people said belonging to the British National Party was posted on the site in October 2009. WikiLeaks also published email exchanges involving U.S. politician Sarah Palin after her account was hacked. The site claims to have information about corrupt banks, the UN, and the Iraq War that is unable to publish while funds remain low. While it has won awards for its work from the Economist and Amnesty International, WikiLeaks has also fought more than 100 legal challenges. WikiLeaks has established a good name for itself and broken some good stories, said Julian Petley, chair of the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, told BBC News. One of the reasons why WikiLeaks is so useful is that it's able to put original documents up, unfiltered by comment and editorial. Investigative journalist Paul Lashmar said he had been startled by the effectiveness of WikiLeaks in publishing suppressed information. However, he thought that the funding issue would not be so easily resolved. Web users aren't interested in how the people behind the sites make the money, he said. The problem for the self-funding model is sites like WikiLeaks will not find it easy to attract funding through advertising. At some point, people who care about free speech will realize that free speech has to be funded. Otherwise, it's not free. So something that's out there that is good to support is something like WikiLeaks that people can take a look at. And they are a bastion of free speech and freely available news that would ordinarily get suppressed in the countries that it's coming out of. So take a look at their site. Unfortunately, none of the information is available right now because they are needing funding to run the website. So hopefully they can get the funding or find a different means of distribution so that they can get the information out there or get more volunteers for their staff so that they can continue on their good work. In privacy news from the US, Google asks NSA to help secure its network. Google is teaming up with the National Security Agency to investigate the recent hack attack against its network in a bid to prevent another assault, according to the Washington Post. The move is raising concerns among privacy and civil rights advocates, but sources assured the Post that the deal does not mean the NSA will have access to users' searches or email communications and accounts, nor will Google share proprietary data with the agency. Google announced earlier this month that it had been the target of a highly sophisticated and coordinated hack attack, since dubbed Operation Aurora, against its network and other companies in the defense, technology, and finance industries. Google said the hackers had stolen intellectual property, presumed to be its source code, and sought access to the Gmail accounts of human rights activists. The attack originated from China, the company said. Computer security firm iDefense said that the 34 companies were targeted by the attackers, who were primarily after source code. A recent report had provided details into the nature of the persistent espionage attack that mirrored attacks on thousands of companies over the last few years, which had largely gone unpublicized. The agreement between Google and the NSA, still being finalized, would allow Google to share critical information with the NSA about the attacks and its network, such as the malicious code that were used and its network configurations without violating Google's policies or laws that protect the privacy of users' communications, the sources say. It would reportedly be the first time Google entered a formal information sharing relationship with the NSA, aside from its general cooperation with subpoenas and national security letters. Nonetheless, Matthew Ade, NSA historian and author of The Secret Century, said the move troubled him. "I'm a little uncomfortable with Google cooperating this closely with the nation's largest intelligence agency, even if it's strictly for defensive purposes," he told the Post. The NSA has been embroiled since 2005 in allegations that the agency violated federal laws in conducting illegal surveillance of Americans' phone and internet communications. Giving agency authority over coordination of the government's cybersecurity plan, which would include working with telecoms and other critical companies in the private sector, could put the agency in the position of surreptitiously monitoring communications. Last year, the Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, raised a ruckus when he told the House Intelligence Committee that the NSA, rather than Department of Homeland Security, which currently oversees cybersecurity for the government, should be in charge of securing cyberspace for government and critical infrastructures. "The National Security Agency is the greatest repository of cyber talent," Blair said. "There are some wizards out there at Fort Meade who can do stuff." NSA Director Lieutenant General Keith Alexander later balked at claims that his agency wanted to control the government's cybersecurity plan and said it wanted to partner with DHS and others in securing networks. Speaking at the RSA Security Conference in San Francisco, he told the audience of security professionals that the NSA does not want to run cybersecurity for the United States government. This week, Blair, commenting on the Google hack, said cyberspace would not be secured without a collaborative effort that incorporates both U.S. private sector and our international partners. As part of its information assurance mission, NSA spokeswoman Judy Emel told the Post, "NSA works with a broad range of commercial partners and research associates to ensure the availability of secure, tailored solution for Department of Defense and National Security Systems customers." So the real question is, do you trust your Google data with the NSA, who has already proved to illegally, not proved, but been accused of illegally recording phones and wiretapping within the U.S. Now, are you going to believe that they're going to truthfully not spy on your searches and email when cooperating with Google and given access to Google's code? Because that's what they're analyzing. So it's something else to keep in mind when you're putting your information into the cloud and trusting these large corporations that are in cooperation now with the government. And are you in fear of retribution from the government for things that you are looking and searching for on the internet, or information you're passing to and from your friends, private communications? Copyright news from the U.S. Grandma endures wrongful ISP piracy suspension. This was sent in by Weird Wolf and Morps. All Kathy Paradiso knew for sure as she learned that her web access was being shut off was that she was losing her struggle to stay calm. To Paradiso, the customer service representative from Quest Communications on the phone with her could have been speaking Slovenian for all the sense it made. Her internet service was suspended. Hollywood Studios accused her of copyright violations. She illegally downloaded 18 films and TV shows: Zombieland, Harry Potter, South Park. What would a 53-year-old grandma want with South Park, she thought to herself. But this was much about what the Quest rep said sank in. If Paradiso was accused of copyright infringement once more, her internet service provider would have no choice but to terminate her account. Paradiso said she was also told that she would have a hard time acquiring new service, as the other ISPs in the area would know her name and what she did. That's very interesting. "Take me off your hit list," Paradiso wrote in a January 15th email plea to some of the studios who had accused her. "I have never downloaded a movie, Period. You'll need to admit you made a mistake and move on to the correct perpetrator. I am saying this once more. My computer is not a toy. My livelihood depends on my ISP's reliability. Look for the perpetrator and leave my service alone. Paradiso, a technical recruiter who works out of her home near Pueblo, Colorado, would eventually be cleared. Last week, Quest had a technician investigate after CNET began making inquiries, and he discovered that her network had been compromised, according to Monica Martinez, a Quest spokeswoman. So Paradiso is off the hook, but she wants to know what would have happened had she not gone to the media. There would be no independent third party to hear her complaint. There was no one to advocate for her. If ISPs are to become copyright cops, a role that companies such as Comcast, Verizon, Cox, and others appear to be warming up to the request of the entertainment sector, then what this case suggests is that there is a need for better safeguards to prevent people from being wrongly accused and cut off the web. This goes to show that there's a problem with the due process in these kinds of situations, said Fred von Lohmann, senior staff attorney of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which advocates for internet users and technology companies. If you're going to kick somebody off the internet, there's a lot of procedures that need to be put in place to protect the innocent. It doesn't look like those were in place here. An attorney who works closely with one of the studios involved and asked to remain anonymous said that these issues are being addressed. Entertainment companies and ISPs agree that there should be some kind of review process, and people accused of copyright violations must also be properly informed before any service disruption takes place. One possible way is to redirect an accused customer's computer screen to a warning notice or to send warnings via certified mail. For ISPs, protecting customers who've been wrongly accused of piracy is just one of the hurdles confronting them. They have been thrust in the middle of a digital tug of war between people's illegally downloading video games, music, and films, and the creators of those materials. Now, I don't see what putting warnings on the screen and warnings through certified mail is going to make any difference than the phone calls they're making to her right now. If it's three strikes, it's going to be three strikes. Either of those ways, that's not going to prevent these kinds of situations from happening. So what is the solution for these type of situations? One is that there's completely open, transparent, being able to look at the customer's computer and go, do you have these files on your computer? And the ISP's looking at them, and the MPAA looking at your computer and sending it off to a lab to analyze whether you have downloaded this or your computer's been compromised or what the situation is. Or the other way is to just stop harassing customers. It's not going to help. This is the kind of fallout that you're going to get, and you're going to get bad press. But the thing is that they've set up a firewall between the entertainment companies and the customers to point the finger at the MPAA, saying they're the bad guy. They're the person who's shutting off the internet. The MPAA, the people who are making these works are the innocent people. No, it's not. The MPAA is hired as a hitman for the corporations of these movies that are being made. And they're going after them on behalf of these people who make movies. Now, this is not going to be solved by going after grandmas and shutting them off the internet. And it's too entrenched in our society that people need the internet. And this is not going to stop piracy taking one person down at a time. It's not going to change the mindset of people. It's gone. It's too far gone. Everybody doesn't agree with the distribution methods and the way media is being distributed nowadays. We are all in the mindset of we are able to access the information. Now, what the entertainment industry needs to understand is to provide a different method for accessing the information. If you provide an easier way to access this information than the torrents, then the download places that you can download it off the internet, people are going to go to those places. If you present a nice web interface, make it easy to access information, make it easily transportable between the devices that you can download it off your computer. You can play it on your video game system. You can bring it on your portable device. You can bring it on vacation with you. Make it easier for the consumer to access your information rather than harder for the average consumer by putting blocks on your media, by putting out these digital locks that make it impossible to play it on things except the ones you sanction. Now, making it easier to the customer is more enticing, and they will flock to you. If you provide it, they will come. Now, the story wraps up with a quote from the grandma who was accused of downloading the copyrighted files. It says, "I'm the last person that would steal somebody's art," Paradiso said. "I never downloaded a movie or song in my life. I'm against it. After going through this, I realized this is the kind of thing that could really hurt artists. I'm so paranoid now, I won't buy music or movies online ever." So you've just lost a customer for the future of distribution of movies and music. People are being scared to even download it off the internet for fear that you go after them for something that's legally distributed, because people don't know the difference now. They just know that they can access it online. If they see a movie being offered, whether it's on a torrent site, whether it's on an official site, whether it's on a site from Russia for a dollar a movie, people aren't able to differentiate the difference between those different places. And all they know is they are able to access a movie on the internet or an album on the internet. It's like having a television. You turn on the channel, there it is. There's a music video. There's a movie. It's in front of you. You're allowed to see it. You're allowed to watch it. It's right there. And they see the internet as that kind of medium as well. It's on their computer. They can click it. They can watch it, whether it's through a torrent download site, or now through Hulu or YouTube. So if you make it easier for people to access your information, like I was saying before, you can draw the viewers in. Now, you could run ads on the side, but make it easy for them to get to it, and they will go to it, because people don't differentiate legal versus non-legal. That people don't have an understanding of the legalities behind copyright. That's for the lawyers. You have to remember that. And if you just sick the lawyers on your customers, you're going to lose the customers. Free speech news from the UK. UK government enlists public to spot terror websites. The UK public can now report terrorism-related websites to authorities for removal from the internet under a new program launched by the British government. The program is a way in which the government is seeking to enforce terrorism acts of 2000 and 2006, which make it illegal to have or share information that's intended to be useful to terrorists, and bans glorifying terrorism or urging people to commit terrorism. People can report websites on direct.co.uk by filling out a web-based form. This form includes categories to describe what's on the website, such as terrorist training material or hate crimes. Content deemed illegal by the UK includes videos of beheadings, messages that encourage racial or terrorist violence, and chat forums revolving around hate crimes, according to the information on direct.co.uk. The reports are anonymous, and then they're reviewed by police officers who are part of the new Counter-Terrorism Internet Referral Unit, run by the Association of Chief Police Officers. A Home Office spokeswoman said that the unit would be responsible for determining the intent of the content posted, which would determine whether in fact it's illegal. But it begs the question of how, for example, chemistry textbooks published by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which have information on poisons and explosives, could be viewed, said Wendy M. Grossman, a member of the Open Rights Group Advisory Council and a freelance technology writer. I suppose the key is intent to be useful to terrorists, and what they're trying to get at is networks of terrorists who educate each other and their recruits, Grossman said. Bottom line is, I don't believe this effort is going to make us any safer, though it may well turn up a few idiots who get prosecuted for basically saying stupid things. Police should review submitted sites fairly quickly, said an ACPO spokeswoman. If the website is hosted in the UK, police would have the ask the hosting provider to take the site offline. If a site is hosted overseas, then police would engage private industry and other law enforcement agencies, she said. The reporting website is a sensible idea, but it's unlikely that many people will know it even exists if they come across the type of material that the government aims to stop, said Struan Robertson, a technology lawyer for Pinsent Masons. I don't think the police anticipate a huge number of submissions, Robertson said. In October 2007, British police arrested a 17-year-old for possessing a copy of The Anarchist Cookbook, a 1970s-era book featuring instructions on homemade bomb-making and other destructive tips. Last month, 38-year-old man pleaded not guilty to 12 terrorism-related charges, including 4 counts of owning information useful to terrorism, according to a BBC News story. One of the counts was for possessing The Anarchist Cookbook, which still is sold today on Amazon.co.uk. And there, in that last sentence, lies the danger of reporting things related to terrorism. Is Amazon.co.uk going to be reported for terrorism? Are they going to take down Amazon in the UK? Are they going to flip through all the books that are listed on Amazon or on other web pages? Or people talking about terrorism? Or, you know, past news reports of terrorism and how the terrorists came to that point? If you suppress history, people aren't going to learn from it. And suppressing information about terrorism is people aren't going to learn about terrorism and the dangers of terrorists. So this is could be a slippery slope into banning websites and being an excuse for banning websites of people that really have no direct connection for terrorism. So it's not about the information, it's about how you use the information. And also, it's this new website is not about the websites that are submitted, it's about what they're going to do with the websites that are submitted, which is kind of dangerous. Now, some privacy news from Canada. Nearly 1,000 Olympic security cameras go live. With just 10 days to go into the opening of the 2010 Winter Games, nearly 1,000 security cameras have been turned on to monitor the crowds, which are already starting to fill the streets. About 900 of the cameras were installed by the RCMP-led Olympic security team around venues for the games, while another 90 cameras were installed by the City of Vancouver around public sites in the downtown area. The integrated security unit team said without the cameras, more police officers would be needed to keep an eye on the Olympic visitors. Privacy watchdogs have expressed concerns the monitoring tramples civic rights. But the RCMP and the city have both said the cameras will be dismantled after the Paralympic Games end in March, and the recordings will only be kept for a limited time. Now, myself, be it living just down the street from the Olympic Games, I have a huge concern about our daily lives being recorded and our privacy, our open privacy, as it should be called, of being tracked daily in our lives for things that really are nobody else's business. I hope that these cameras come down as they promise after the Olympic Games, but it's a perfect excuse to maybe just, you know, turn them off, but keep them on the lamppost and then later use them because they're already paid for and up on the lamppost. So hopefully there's some people out there in Vancouver that can keep them on task and keep them to their promises that they will come down afterwards, that so that Vancouver doesn't turn into something like London, where every move you make is watched and such expense is paid. Well, they've already paid close to $1 billion for security in Vancouver, so all this expense isn't paid for nothing. Open government news from Denmark. Denmark adopts ODF and PDF/A. Central government bodies in Denmark will have to use open document formats, including ODF from 2011. The Danish parliament has ruled the open document format will be the only editable format in the list of approved formats for the Danish government use. According to a statement made on Friday by the ODF Alliance, an industry group that promotes the format, non-editable documents are to be stored in the PDF/A specification, an open standards variant of Adobe's popular PDF format that is intended for long-term archiving. Today's decision by Denmark reflects the growing specific demand and support for ODF, especially among governments. ODF Alliance Chief Marino Marchese said in the statement, open standard-based interoperabilities through ODF offers real value to governments in terms of choice of IT solutions, savings, and long-term access to data. Marchese said that the vendors should take note of the open standards-based interoperability that their customers, particularly the public sector, are demanding. According to reports, the mandatory use of open standards format in Denmark will be in place from 1st of April 2011, starting in national institutions and moving later to councils and regional institutions. Denmark is the latest in the string of countries to back ODF over proprietary rivals, such as Microsoft's OOXML format. Other notable adopters of the format include Belgium, Brazil, and South Africa. ODF documents can be read and edited by a variety of productivity suites, including OpenOffice and Microsoft Office 2007. So I applaud the government of Denmark for adopting free software, and so that the public can also download and use free software to be able to view their own government's paperwork, which is wonderful for striving for open government. One step closer for Denmark. Patent news from the U.S. Rights groups argue against human gene patent. This was sent in by Shiny Black Roses. Patent on two human genes associated with breast and ovarian cancer should be declared invalid because they stifle the free flow of information and hamper research, lawyers told a New York judge on Tuesday. A lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups last May posed a broad challenge to gene patent and its outcoming and could have far-reaching effects because one in five human genes are patented. The specific case argued on Monday at Manhattan Federal Court concerning a patent on two genes held by Myriad Genetics. Mutations on those genes are responsible for most cases of hereditary breast and ovarian cancers. Myriad uncovered a law of nature, and they deserve credit for having done so. But laws of nature are not patentable, said Chris Hansen, attorney with the ACLU. But a lawyer for Myriad dismissed the litigation as a test case to go after gene patents and the biotech industry as a whole, and said patents have a positive impact on human health because they promote innovation. This is not nature's handiwork. This is the handwork of man, said Brian Poisson, a lawyer for Myriad. It could be months before the judge issues a ruling. The lawsuit by the ACLU, the Association for Molecular Pathology, Individual Women, and others was brought against the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, Myriad Genetics, and the University of Utah Research Foundation, which hold the patents on the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Now, this is a very interesting court case going against the patenting of human genes. Now, the scary part of this story is that one in five human genes are already patented. So the companies own 1/20th of the human race already, and people are not allowed to work with those genes that are patented because of fear of lawsuits. So really the research is locked down on 20% of humans so far. The lawyer for Myriad says it has a positive impact on human health because it promotes innovation. Now, how can locking down human 1/5, 20% of human genes in patents promote innovation? I don't see the connection there. It sounds a little bit like doublespeak. Yeah, we're going to lock it down so it promotes innovation. Not so much. So they're really saying that By promoting a monetary incentive to be able to take away the freedom to experiment with humans and to try and discover new cures for diseases, that's going to promote innovation. Well, hopefully that these people who do have these patents use them wisely that already have them, or it be struck down rather than patenting the human body and have it locked away for nobody else to take a look at it. What happens when we get to 100% of the human body being patented? Are no individuals allowed to do research to help cure diseases? Otherwise, they have to go and pay a company to be able to look at the human body. Very, very disturbing outcomes could come from patenting human genomes. In Pirate Party news, congratulations to the Russian Pirate Party, who elected its first official leadership. On January 19th through the 21st, 2010, the first elections of the Russian Pirate Party's leadership have taken place. The eight members of the party's founding committee voted through the party's public forum, according to the election rules set up previously. The newly elected chairman is Stanislav Shakirov, recently turned 23, an MSU mathematics graduate from Moscow who runs a small IT consultancy. He received 7 of 8 votes. Edgar Voskresky from Moscow became the vice chairman. The founding committee decided unanimously that all its members should join the party council. Currently, the Russian Pirate Party is an unofficial organization and part of the international pirate movement. The PPR has supporters in many major Russian cities. Estimates give the total number of party sympathists at about 800, with 50 active participants and 8 members of the founding committee. So congratulations on the Russian Pirate Party for that step in the right direction. And remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party, such as if you're in Russia, and find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to thepiratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.